organizers. I certainly learned a lot this week, and I'll try to make your final afternoon after a long week very painless. So this talk is going to be extremely simple. I'm going to discuss free field theory the whole time. And to the extent that hard work was involved, it was done by Shaitan or by Mike Mulligan. My former student is now at MIT. Okay, so here's the outline of what I'll say. I'm going to begin with an introduction that has three motivations. More of you are condensed matter theorists than the people at places where I normally give this talk, so you may not be as unmotivated as they normally are, but I'll find motivated anyhow. Then I'll discuss some topological aspects of the theory I'm discussing. I'll talk about a novel anisotropic phase that this free theory exhibits, which is of the most interest for the physics application. I'll do a bunch of computations of convectivities, compressibilities, and so forth, which are what somebody who actually found such a phase would measure. And I'll finally conclude, and inevitably in my conclusion, because I'm a string theorist, I will mention gravity rules and ADS-CFT, but I will confine this to the last two slides of my talk. So until then, you have no excuse. You have to understand everything. So here are the motivations. You all know this system better than me. You can trap a gas of electrons in a semiconductor heterojunction. You can subject them to a 5 or 10 Tesla magnetic field. And the result, if you pick the right kind of sample, is the Hall effect. So it's the physics of a planar electron gas in a transverse magnetic field. And although this sounds very simple, it's been actually a very rich and fruitful theoretical and experimental playground for almost 30 years. Now, if you're very clever, you can actually just write down the wave function for this very complicated, strongly interacting system. Okay, this is a miracle to me that people can manage to guess such wave functions, but at least this all did. That, for a string theorist or field theorist, is a very unusual way to think, and I'm not going to talk about wave functions again. I'm instead going to proceed with a systematic effective field theory approach that has been developed to understanding such systems by other authors. There are many more, too, who are involved after the wave function was guessed. Okay, so how would an effective field theorist try to analyze the system? Well, the essential physics is two-dimensional, 2+1-dimensional, because we have confined the electrons. They're strongly interacting, okay? The system can be at high density. We don't really know how to guess the right quasi particles, but we do know there's a conserved electromagnetic current, so this is a safe thing to say. I'm going to be interested in the physics at long distances and large times, or small wave numbers and low frequencies, so I don't care about lattices. And finally, the result of the background magnetic field is that we expect this 2+1-dimensional theory to have P and T ratings. Now, in 2+1 dimensions, given a conserved current, so divergence of the current is zero, we can write it as a curl, which is what I've done here. So without loss of generality, this conserved J is curled A, where little a is a gauge field, a vector field. And the reason I call it a gauge field is if you change little a by a gauge transformation, J mu doesn't change. So you get, in this way, an emergent gauge field, which is why I can talk about this in the emergence workshop. It emerges by just thinking about the conserved current. So it's important that this gauge field is not the photon. Okay, so now we just apply standard logic. The low energy action, as in Andreas' talk and in Sabir's talk, you can write down by writing down the lowest dimension operators consistent with all the symmetries. So we only have one field that I've motivated the existence of, little a. And so, what can I write down? Well, the first thing I would write down, because I was educated in four dimensions, is f mu nu, or which Andreas wrote down, e squared minus b squared. But in fact, in three dimensions, there's another term you can write down that's gauge-invariant that has one less derivative, which is, of course, the Chern-Simons term. So here's the Lagrangian you would start by writing down. Here, E is dimensionless and lambda is the cutoff. So this theory, clearly the Maxwell term is irrelevant. It has dimension 4 when the Chern-Simons term has dimension 3. And so this is going to be a Chern-Simons theory at low energies. So this is actually a marvelous success of the whole effective field theory idea, using just this kind of elementary reasoning, and starting from this abelian Chern-Simons theory, one can actually, if one is clever, derive the phenomenology of the simplest odd denominator decoupling fractions in the fractional quantum Hall effect. Okay, so this incredibly strongly coupled system about which you know nothing actually yields to this very, very simple set of ideas.
Here's a natural question, at least natural for a field theorist. The irrelevant Maxwell term here does not change any of the physics in the deep infrared. You could detect it if you worked hard and made high energy excitations. Now, a priori, you might wonder, are there other extensions in terms of field theory of the Chern-Simons theory that we could imagine arising theoretically or maybe in real systems and that would change the observable properties in the infrared? So this is one motivation for my talk. Here's a second motivation, which is related a little bit to things Eduardo talked about. So here's the famous phase diagram of a sort of a triple point in a ferromagnet. And at that critical point, the theory that governs the fluctuations, it's an infrared scale invariant fixed point, but it's not Lorentz invariant. It has non-trivial dynamical scaling. So x and t both scale, but they scale with different powers of the rescaling parameter lambda. This is not an unnatural situation in condensed matter, because Lorentz invariance is not a particularly natural symmetry there. So, in fact, the theory that arises in this phase diagram, and also in a different context, in toy models of spin systems, like the Rotschler-Kittleson model, is this thing. It's the simplest analog of free field theory that has non-trivial dynamical critical exponent. So this actually has a phi dot squared term in three dimensions, but it has del squared phi squared. The gradient term is fourth order instead of second order. So this is a free scalar field theory, but it has dynamical exponent too. If you scale time twice as quickly as space, you can see this is a free scale invariant theory. And in fact has a line of scale invariant fixed points parameterized phi kappa. Now, there's no particular reason you'd want to do this to analyze a free theory, but if you're bloody-minded, you could dualize this into a gauge theory also. Okay, you could rewrite phi in terms of a dual photon, and in first-order phase-space form, where E is formally independent from A, you get an action that looks like this, where the Hamiltonian is just dE squared plus B squared, instead of E squared plus B squared. And with the gauge field scaling inversely of the coordinates, this gauge theory also, of course, enjoys its equals to scaling. Now, this theory, this scalar theory or gauge theory, has three potentially interesting perturbations. And two of them have been studied, pretty extensively in the literature. Okay, first of all, you could perturb by the standard quadratic in the electric field. There was a dE squared in our Hamiltonian. E squared is a relevant perturbation. And with the right sign, that would cause you to flow to Maxwell Chern-Simons, which would become Chern-Simons in the deep infrared. You can also perturb by a quartic in the electric field. I don't know what that's doing there. with the scaling that I announced for the fixed point theory that has this only single relevant perturbation, this is not relevant, but it's marginal. And in fact, as these authors computed, in the theory I'm mentioning, it's marginally irrelevant. Okay, so if you turn this on with the sign that leaves the potential bounded, it flows to zero in the deep infrared. Finally, and this is what I'm really going to talk about, you can consider the theory with this action.
Here we have the gauge form of that sort of Lifshitz scalar action, but we've added a Chern-Simons term for the dual photon. Or if you formally solved for the E field and reinserted, okay, this is in first order form, so we could solve for E and try to write it in a more conventional way, this is exactly a theory that has a Chern-Simons term and is perturbed it by B squared plus dE squared for the abelian gauge field. This solving for E is a slightly non-local thing to do, but away from zero momenta, it's safe. And so you should keep in mind that at zero momenta, you should be able to care. So you might call this the abelian Lifshitz Chern-Simons theory. And what's interesting about this theory is that the Chern-Simons term looks marginal from the point of view of the z equals 2 fixed point, and vice versa. The Chern-Simons term is topological. With any scaling, it will look marginal. So this theory, in fact, has not Maxwell, but some other dynamical gauge field action competing on equal footing with a topological term.
For why this would be.
I'll get there in 1 second.
Okay.
You mean from some phenomenon that has been seen somewhere?
Well, or some Hamiltonian that you can cook up.
You mean a Lattice model?
Yeah.
No, but I'll give you an experiment in a second. You all know more about the experiment than me, but I'll give you that. Okay, so this theory might be expected to arise if you combine the circumstances that normally give rise to z equals 2 scaling with P and T violating background fields. I'm talking about it as a gauge theory, because if I try to do it in the scalar language, The Chern-Simons term actually becomes a non-local perturbation of the scalar theory. So this is best thought of in terms of the gauge theory. So I'm going to take the attitude, this is sort of in contrast to what Sabir was asking, that because this is a simple perturbation of two different physical theories that have shown up in nature, and since it's solvable, we should just solve it. Okay? But ultimately, the usefulness of this thing would, of course, be determined by whether the space structure that I find and the transport properties that I compute actually do show up in any observed system. And in fact, I have added a third motivation, which arose actually after we finished the work here, that comes from experiment. Okay, so there are weird goings-on of higher filling fraction in the quantum Hall effect. So for some time, the labs at Caltech of Eisenstein and also a group at Princeton has been doing interesting experiments where they take the 2D electron gas and they move the B field down to where some higher Landau levels are also filled. So with B fields and electron densities in this vicinity, so I put this in so there would be some units somewhere in my talk, okay, and with these kinds of filling fractions, Willey et al. Found about a decade ago new evidence for anisotropic states in these quantum Hall systems, which have non-zero but anisotropic longitudinal conductivity, and have unquantized Hall conductivity. And this is an interesting subject. It's been studied for a long time. I think Eduardo is certainly an expert, and there's a large literature on electron pneumatic phases that might well be related to this. So here's some kind of plot of their data at filling fraction 9s. Now, more recently, actually 2 months ago, in the March meeting, another of Eisenstein's postdocs, Jay Zha, gave actually dramatic evidence of a new kind of anisotropic phase in the 2D electron gas, which they called the quantum Hall pneumatic. And what's interesting about this phase is that it still has anisotropic longitudinal transport, but the Hall conductance remains quantized. So there's some kind of hallmark of topology still in the system. And here's some kind of plots of their data. The way they make these samples is, well, the way they do these experiments is they take the Hall system in a standard magnetic field and they start tilting it. And they observe a phase transition as a function of the tilt. And you see here a nice plateau with quantized sigma x1. And here are the anisotropic longitudinal bits.
Okay.
Yeah, you mean you have to be at finite frequency? Or?
Yeah, it means that, of course, if you go all the way down to very low temperature, it disappears.
Yeah, that's fine. So
otherwise, it will ruin the quantum.
The quantum, yeah. Okay, so here's my loose experimental motivation. The normal quantum Hall phases are well described by a Chern-Simons theory. Okay, in fact, the abelian Chern-Simons theory I wrote down. The Lipschitz Chern-Simons theory that I wrote down has exactly one relevant operator. And that one relevant operator, as a function of the coefficient, tunes this Lipschitz-Chern-Simons theory between a Maxwell-Chern-Simons phase and an anisotropic phase, which I'll discuss. And in fact, well, they're separated by the quantum critical point that I described, the free quantum critical point, with z equals 2. And so it's at least plausible that this kind of theory may play some role in the phenomena seen in these experiments. It's a one-parameter deformation of quantum Hall, whose coefficient could vary as a function of the tilt. So anyway, I'm hoping that these sort of free motivations will convince you to tolerate a string theorist talking about condensed matter for 40 minutes. And before I go on to the really interesting thing...
You have less than 40 minutes left.
So I guess the beer doesn't want the motivation. Okay, so before I go on to the actual transport and describe how this could be related to the phases I just talked about, I'm going to explore some more formal theoretical issues, which are also kind of interesting. Okay, so this theory, despite the fact that it's quantum critical, has some interesting topological properties.
You know, the Chern-Simons theory is famous for being a topological field theory. Witten won the Fields Medal in part for showing that the computable observables, the Wilson loops in this theory, are related to the Jones polynomials. Now, partially, again, growing out of Chern-Simons theory, studies of what are called topologically ordered states in condensed matter, which very loosely speaking, I think Matthew defined these much more carefully, but loosely, these are gapped models that have degenerate ground states when they're on non-trivial topologies, but which are not distinguished by a simple Landau order parameter. Studies of such systems have taken on a life of their own. Okay, they're classified by complicated algebras with many indices on the defining properties. But I think Chern-Simons is still the canonical example. And its two most interesting properties in this regard are things we've heard about already earlier today. One is, when you put the the theory on a topologically non-trivial space, for instance, a Riemann surface of genus G, you will actually find almost degenerate ground states, where I'll say what almost means in a second. Okay, so how would you study this? Well, Andreas described it earlier this morning. So in searching for ground states, first of all, unless the system is going to break spontaneously translation invariance, you can restrict to zero momentum modes. So you truncate to just time-dependent modes of the gauge field. So in Maxwell Chern-Simons theory, okay, that yields a quantum mechanics problem where on a torus, for instance, you'd have an action that looked like A dot squared coming from the Maxwell terms and then these terms coming from Chern-Simons. So this really just becomes a problem involving two Wilson line zero modes on the torus. Now, these Wilson lines themselves live on a dual torus, the Jacobian, and they're governed by this action. I just renamed them. It's x dot y minus y dot x plus x dot squared plus y dot squared. Now, if I hadn't talked about topological and Chern-Simons and all this nonsense, you would recognize this immediately. This is just the Lagrangian for a particle in a magnetic field, okay, where the B field is their k units of magnetic flux threading the plane. So the quantum mechanics of such a particle was studied actually by Landau, but it was studied in a more fancy way by these people. Okay, and if you choose this particular asymmetric gauge where all the magnetic flux is reflected in AY, you'll find that the ground state is K-fold degenerate, as Andreas said, if the Chern-Simons level is K. And the wave functions of the ground states can actually be written explicitly on the torus. They have this very fancy-looking form, which is really just the expression for a theta function. Now, the result actually isn't that fancy. As I said, this is basically the physics of Landau levels. So with that gauge choice that I mentioned, you can view the wave functions as being harmonic oscillators in one direction and momentum modes in the other. And all that's going on is the harmonic oscillator modes are centered about particular lines in Y space, in the transverse direction, to the center of the oscillator. And when you go to too high a level, you run out of space in the Y direction. So there's a finite number of modes in the first Landau level, or the zeroth Landau level. So only a certain number of momentum modes fit, and you actually get K modes for each value of the harmonic oscillator principal quantum number. Now, the same analysis could be done at higher genus with even more fancy theta functions appearing. And the result there would be, on a genus G surface, there are K to the G degenerate ground states. And more precisely, and this came out in questions that were asked of Andreas, on a system with finite size L, the point is there are a bunch of modes whose mass goes like 1 over L, but these ground states are split by an amount that's exponentially small in L. So there's a mass scale having to do with the gap to quasiparticles, and the splitting of these ground states vanishes exponentially quickly as you make the system work. Okay, here's the second very interesting property, which is, again, thought to be characteristic of a topological phase. The Chern-Simons theory has chiral edge modes when you put it on a space with boundary. Okay, so here's a quantum Hall sample, here's the boundary, and you get maybe a fermion moving this way or around the circle. The meaning of this is more or less self-explanatory, and the derivation is actually most elegantly done via the anomaly. So if you try to formulate a Chern-Simons gauge theory on a space with boundary, the gauge variation of the action under a gauge transformation by F picks up a boundary term that looks like the function F wedge, the field strength. Now, for the level K theory, well, for any non-zero K, this is a disaster. An anomalous gauge theory is inconsistent. But you can fix the disaster by adding a localized mode on the boundary that cancels the anomalous variation. And in fact, for K equals 1, that can be achieved by a single chiral fermion. And for higher K, there's a simple generalization involving a chiral boson. Now, such edge modes are thought to be characteristic of topological phases in general, and in one of the classifications of topological insulators, they in fact play a crucial role. The edge modes are classified. Now, both the chiral edge modes and these degenerate ground states have usually been, at least in papers that I've read, implicitly assumed to be related to the topological nature of this theory, and in particular, the gapped nature of the bulk. One of the interesting things about the theory I'm talking about today is that it exhibits both the chiral edge modes and the ground state degeneracy, even when it's a gapless critical theory involved. So this is in contrast to, for instance, Maxwell Chern-Simons, which was shown in the early 80s by Jakeef and others to be massive. So despite the fact that there are excitations in the bulk, the edge modes don't decay. So the persistence of the edge modes is very clear. Their presence is still required to cancel a non-vanishing gauge variation. When you put this theory on a space with boundary, it wouldn't be gauge invariant otherwise. But more intuitively, you could say the following. View the new dynamical terms, the Lifshitz terms, as a perturbation of Chern-Simons theory. Well, then you could, in principle, perturb the Lagrangian of the edge modes and give them ways to decay when you add this Lifshitz perturbation. But the fact about that chiral boson theory is that it's a purely chiral theory that actually has no relevant perturbations. So in this sort of sloppy way of talking, it's going to be robust under the addition of any kind of perturbation to the bulk as long as it's a small perturbation, because it can't create a relevant perturbation. Any what?
Splitting between the, so you said you have the generative ground states.
The splitting, I think, in this theory, like in the other theory.
But now you don't have M, right?
Does M?
You don't have M.
No, I'll show you what the splitting is like in a second. But sorry, I mean, we are going to actually have a scale M. It comes from two different sources. One is you could actually put in, I mean, you could put in the lightest non-trivial quasi-particles that I integrated out aren't even going to the Chern-Simons description. But the other thing is, as we'll get to in a second, there will generally be a marginally relevant perturbation. Marginally irrelevant perturbation, rather, that gives a scale. Okay. And those would be the same scale. Okay. The ground state degeneracy also persists for the following intuitive reason. So let's consider the theory now, and as I said, with a regulating marginally irrelevant perturbation lambda. Okay. That's there. You'll see later why it's important in analyzing the phase diagram, but it's also there in this case to make sure we get the first non-zero energetics right. So with that perturbation, you can just solve for the Hamiltonian canonically. You'll get a Hamiltonian that looks like pi minus a squared. If you look at the thing in brackets here,
so what's this thing over I?
This is just the indices on the electric field. One and two.
It's still local.
Yeah. Sum on one and two. Okay. So this is actually a Hamiltonian that's just the square of the Hamiltonian that was analyzed by Haldane and Rezaian. So the degeneracies of all states in this Mandel level-like problem are the same as they were before, but the spacing between the levels is now quadratic. Okay, and so the k degenerate ground states are separated from the first level by this amount.
So this is at the critical point.
Yeah. Okay, so now I'm going to start perturbing. If you add the Maxwell term, or the E squared term,
you could add it with some arbitrary coefficient and sign r. Okay, and then there are going to be three regions in the phase diagram. The region where r is positive, the region where r is negative, and the critical theory where r vanishes. And the first two are new, and the third is especially here, sorry, the latter two are new, and the third here is especially interesting. So let me discuss it first, and then I'll discuss the transport in all three. Okay, so clearly, if r is less than zero, what's the system doing? There's a system with a minus e squared plus e to the fourth type of Hamiltonian, so that's a standard Higgs potential. So for r less than zero, the electric field will develop an expectation value, spontaneously breaking the SO2 rotation symmetry. So here it is. You can choose whatever vacuum you want for the E field, and without loss of generality, I'll put the condensate in the X direction. So there are small fluctuations, E tilde X and EY, left over expanding around this ground state. And if you re-expand, well, just do Taylor's theorem, you find some kind of simple Hamiltonian. It still has a Chern-Simons term. And the most relevant properties of this Hamiltonian are that, well, first of all, the low-energy theory is gapless because of the Goldstone boson associated with SO2 breaking, and it has Z equals 1. So you can just read off the propagators. It's amazing to me how messy these propagators get, even in a free theory, but I guarantee you this is what you get by inverting the matrix. Okay, so here are the propagators for E. The K tildes and kappa tildes here are just defined in terms of the Chern-Simons coupling and the gauge coupling. And all that you should glean from this mess of propagators is that there's a gapless Goldstone mode whose dispersion relation looks like this. So at low energies, this is a quartic term in momenta. It's irrelevant. But the Goldstone mode has anisotropic velocities. It moves differently in the x and y directions. And in fact, if k is 0, it even has anisotropic scaling. Okay, that would just be the old Lipschitz theory. Now, here I assumed an exact rotation symmetry that was broken. It's actually true that in most systems, I'm told by people at station Q who are very experimentally inclined, that this exact symmetry would be broken by the underlying crystalline lattice and by disorder. And so one shouldn't actually treat the exactly rotation symmetric system alone. So we actually tried to study both of these a little bit. Okay, to model lattice symmetry breaking, all you do is, to zeroth order, introduce anisotropic stiffnesses in the EX and EY directions. Okay, that will break the SO2 down to D2 or something. And then if you re-expand this theory about the symmetry breaking VEV, you find this Hamiltonian. So now there's actually a quadratic term for both legs of the E field. And if you integrate it out, okay, you get this Hamiltonian. And the point of all these integrations is not for you to follow in real time simple integrals. It's that after doing this addition of the anisotropy, you actually end up with an anisotropic Maxwell-Chern-Simons theory with a gap. So in particular in this phase, we expect a well-quantized Hall conductance, but also that finite temperature and frequency transport will be anisotropic. Now, it turns out that in these states that I've written down right here, if you go and compute, the anisotropy will reflect itself in anisotropy of dielectric constants, okay, imaginary parts of the longitudinal conductivity. But as in the Hall states, there's no real longitudinal conductivity. Finally, we can add disorder. Okay, how do you add disorder? The simplest way I'm told to do this is to introduce some kind of random couplings into the system. Yeah. This is expanding around r less than 0. So this is the anisotropic phase, but including also explicit SO2 breaking. Yeah.
Right now, this is just a mental.
It's fully gap.
It's fully gap.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Okay, finally, we can consider the addition of disorder. The simplest way to do this is to just change some of the couplings of the action to be random functions. So again, we do the simplest thing. We have EX squared and EY terms, you know, EY squared terms with different coefficients. We promote them to random functions of position. And we assume, because this is what everyone does in the first pass of doing randomness, that these random R couplings are Gaussian white noise correlated with zero mean and with variances given by two parameters, WX and WY, or W1 and W2. And then you can compute disorder average correlators using the replica trick. We've heard about that many times in this conference. I will not try to explain the replica trick. The only important point for me will be that the disorder will contribute to self-energies of the Lipschitz-Chern-Simons modes. If that is, the propagators will get small imaginary shifts. And this will give rise to real longitudinal conductivity in non-zero frequency. Okay, it's very analogous to a non-expert like me to just adding some kind of scattering time in the Drew model. So to summarize what I've said so far, systems with explicit SO2 breaking are expected to exhibit anisotropic imaginary longitudinal conductivities, but well-quantized Hall conductivity. And the addition of disorder should give rise to real longitudinal components, which remain anisotropic. It's dissipative because of the disorder. Well, let me go on and okay. I'll show you the problems. Okay, and then finally, when the system is actually SO2 invariant to an excellent approximation, there would be a Goldstone boson, and that would change transport in a bizarre way. Okay, so now let me discuss response functions at the critical point. So to do that, we take our fake gauge field, which came from this current J mu, and we couple it to the electromagnetic field A mu, which is the real photon. Now, the action that we're studying is quadratic. I mean, up to small regulating e to the fourth terms. So we can actually just integrate out the emergent gauge field and write an action for A, big A, which takes the form big A times some K matrix, K mu nu times big A. And all transport properties are summarized by the properties of this K matrix. So for instance, the conductivity is obtained from this quadratic term by just taking 1 over I omega plus delta times K. And since our current was defined in this way as epsilon times the gauge field, the emergent gauge field,
In fact, this K matrix is nothing but a two-point function of A's with suitable powers of the momentum pulled out to represent the derivative. So let's just go through the computations and see what we get. The r greater than 0 phase, this is just obviously a Maxwell turn-Simon state. You find, somewhat unsurprisingly, that anywhere close to small frequencies, sigma xx and sigma xy vanish,
and that the compressibility, which is the momentum goes to zero limit of k00, actually vanishes. Okay, this is exactly what you expect. So these vanish. This is 1 over 2 pi k. And so this is exactly the expected DC response of a quantum Hall system. And then these sort of massive things you could ignore, they're associated with non-universal physics above the gap. Okay, moving right along, at the critical theory, if you imagine you could actually exactly hit the critical point, and you ignore the perturbation by the marginally irrelevant operator, so you're at very long wavelengths, you actually find that the real parts and imaginary parts of all the components of the conductivity identically vanish as a function of frequency. Okay, this would never happen once you add any kind of small perturbation, the irrelevant operator or disorder or anything else. But in the cleanest limit, the critical theory actually has identically vanishing conductivities. So as the gap from the quantum Hall phase collapses, rather shockingly, the system actually becomes more insulating. And the reason is that this is a very weird critical theory, where you can show that the dynamical fields don't couple to spatially homogeneous electric fields regardless of frequency at all. You need spatial inhomogeneity to get coupling. That's because of the strange Z equals 2 structure of the action. So if this theory had anything to do with any experimental system, this is how you would tell. You would tune to the critical point and look for very strange behavior as the Hall phase collapses. Okay, and this critical point has finite compressibility. Okay, finally, let's go to the anisotropic phase. So in this phase, the Hamiltonian looks like this. Okay, with a dE squared in one direction and an E squared in the other, depending on how we broke rotational symmetry. So this is an ungodly mix of the critical phase and the Hall phase. This looks Hall-like, this looks critical. And the leading transport properties actually reflect this. You find vanishing longitudinal conductivity in one direction, but you actually find superconducting behavior in the other. Sorry?
Why don't you have EY?
So as soon as I either add explicit SO2 breaking or disorder, I will.
Okay,
so this is the cleanest limit, and now I'll go through what happens as we make it dirtier and dirtier. But in the cleanest limit, the Goldstone mode makes the system anisotropic, and you actually get this sort of weird insulator superconductor hybrid.
So it's an XY pneumatic.
It's not strictly speaking a pneumatic because the order parameter has a direction, but the leading terms in the effective field theory actually have pneumatic symmetry. So this is a very weird thing, and as Sevier is saying, likely this would be smoothed out by any kind of perturbations.
So the quartic term that you had before is turned off here? Or?
Yeah. That was with no perturbations at all. Okay, now if there's some inbuilt intrinsic anisotropy in the system, then the transport becomes instead, as I said, characteristic of anisotropic quantum Hall. Here's the well-quantized sigma xy. Here we have purely imaginary sigma xx and yy, and vanishing compressibility. Okay, and this is getting pretty close, in my sort of hand-waving string theory, to the recent experimental result that was announced at the March meeting. But there's still no real longitudinal conductivity at non-zero frequency or temperature, while Zhao et al. Actually measures them. And finally, if we include disorder, which adds a little bit of width, we find the leading answers look like this. And the leading imaginary piece that appears now that actually gives real conductivity longitudinally is related to the disorder in the y direction. That's because when you did the replica trick, which I didn't go through in detail for you, you would have found that of the two disorder parameters I introduced, one gives rise to a very relevant operator expanding around the scaling exponents for the phase, and that's the disorder in the y direction. So that actually generates a width. So now we have a system that has quantized Hall conductance, non-zero longitudinal conductivity, and anisotropic results. Okay, so that shows great qualitative similarity to what I just showed you in the third motivation for this talk. It's a phase that has well-quantized Hall conductivity, the other hallmarks of that new phase, and is a simple one-parameter deformation of the Chern-Simons theory that captures that phase in its normal state.
But there's no localization anywhere.
I did not add any localization, and I didn't discuss plateaus.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. So conclusion. To conclude, because I'm a string theorist, I have to discuss gravity. So I'm going to start by discussing a subject that's really been comprehensively studied and tell you my take on it, and then I'll discuss a side of the subject that's almost totally neglected. Okay, so you all heard by now, at least from John's talk yesterday, if nowhere else, that there are metrics that string theorists think are gravity duals to 2 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theories. Okay, so here is the metric of Minkowski 2 plus 1 dimensional space, and you add an extra holographic direction r, which geometrizes the scale invariance of the conformal field theory in this 2 plus 1 dimensional plane. Now, in many real condensed matter systems,
as was the theme of this talk, Lorentz invariance is not a particularly natural symmetry, since it's always broken by the UV theory. So why should we expect this accidental SO2,1 to ever be relevant in the gravity duals we're talking about? I would say in general we shouldn't. A simple way that you could geometrize more general classes of scale invariant theories that would still enjoy rotation and translation symmetries would be this class of metrics, okay, with some varying parameter z that characterizes the dynamical critical exponent. So with Liu and Mulligan a few years ago, we derived these solutions from suitable gravity theories and showed that they have many of the same properties that the solutions arising in ADS-CFT enjoy. Now, solutions that support this metric don't arise in pure Einstein gravity with a negative cosmological term, as ADS does, but they rise in simple cousins. This is simple for string theorists. For normal people, this is Einstein gravity with a cosmological term and a massive abelian vector field. Depending on the value of the constant c, you can vary z. The values you get are always bigger than 1, but otherwise, at this level, they're unfixed. In microscopic constructions, 2 is the easiest value of lambda. Okay, probably more importantly, and this is why I'm actually talking about it, this kind of metric also arises spontaneously. If you start with an ADS-CFT dual pair, you add charge density, you look at what emerges in the infrared, it turns out that emergent infrared fixed points in gravity studies of duals to condensed matter systems have often given this kind of metric as capturing the infrared physics. Okay, so John talked yesterday about probe fermions in anti-de Sitter space, whose physics gives rise to a non-Fermi liquid. If you look at those solutions and you include back reaction of the fermion, in fact, you get perturbed away from anti-de Sitter space to one of these metrics with z of order n. If you add scalar fields to ADS, you get perturbed away from ADS Reisner-Nordström to one of these spacetimes that depends on the neutral scalar. If you try to make simple models of the strange metallic phase, as Hartnell et al. Did, you also land on theories that have non-trivial z. Okay, so these weird Lifshitz spacetimes are one simple class of solutions that seem to emerge in the infrared naturally when you turn on charge density in ADS-CFT. And my message isn't that you should study them, but that probably many other such solutions characteristic of infrared behavior remain to be found, and probably the simplest math problem left to do in ADS-CMT, stated as a general problem, is to classify symmetry-breaking phases of extremal black holes in 3 plus 1 dimensions, which I think can be turned into a well-posed problem. It would require solving partial differential equations, so maybe it can't be done, but it can be well-posed. Okay, and finally, I talked in this almost the entirety of my talk about an abelian gauge theory. The Lifshitz gauge theory, without Chern-Simons term, is free, and it has vanishing beta functions in the abelian case. And that's why I felt free to just study it with the Chern-Simons term. There was nothing left to determine. In the non-abelian case, that theory is actually interacting to begin with, and it was conjectured to be relevant to certain loop gas models by our friends at Station Q. And so it seems like an interesting independent problem to write down this gauge theory and, if you want, finish the gross Politzer-Wilczek program of computing beta functions. So this is some interacting theory. It's scale invariant at tree level, even though it's a pure gauge theory in 3 dimensions. So what are its beta functions? Now, there are many couplings, because gauge invariance without Lorentz invariance doesn't fix a single gauge coupling. And there are also a couple of marginal terms that are allowed by all the symmetries that could appear. So you have to solve for the beta functions if it turns out 3 independent coupling constants up to scaling. The gauge coupling constants in this theory do run. It is not a finite theory. It is not in a line of fixed points. This contradicts some things that were said in old work on loop gases. And the current indications that we found are some of the gauge couplings run strong and some run weak. So this is a gauge theory which is not asymptotically free, even though it's a pure gauge theory in 3 dimensions. It also has novel possible instabilities about the origin, They're more general than the kind I talked about today, but they're non-perturbative in nature. They're tunneling instabilities, and so we can ignore them at the level of computing beta functions. So anyway, one thing that we're doing with Mulligan and Nayak is trying to find non-trivial fixed points, or at least determine the leading order beta functions, in these non-abelian theories, which could have gravity duals at large n, or also, you know, study the Chern-Simons couplings of these theories and see if they give generalizations of the phases I talked about today. But these things remain projects for a distant future. So thanks for your patience.
More questions?
So in the Einstein experiment, or the Shea experiment, I guess it should be called, there is an explicit symmetry breaking field there. It's a magnetic field.
Which is tilted, yeah.
Which is tilted, okay. And so the phase that gets restabilized is a little more complicated than this one. It's one of the non-abelian phases.
Yeah. So, the question would then be whether that phase, that field may be the largest symmetry breaking in the problem, or it may not be. So it could be that as they tilt it, that they're actually, okay. Clearly the theory I talked about here would only be at all relevant to those experiments if, as you change that macroscopic tilt, you're for some reason inducing flow of the parameter R, okay? And then the question would be whether the spontaneous breaking you get from R going negative is a larger effect than the explicit effect of the direction of the field. And that, you know, I just did long wavelength effective field theory. I have no idea what's happening.
What is true in that experiment is that the region of an isotropy that they see is actually widened significantly from what they had expected before.
So that sounds good, actually.
That sounds good. Yeah. So there's some degree of self-organization right now. So people suspect that there's a competition, actually, between the pneumatic phase and the phi half state. And they're very close in energy, actually, in numerics. So it's possible to. But the state that you have that is an isotropic is actually not.
So you'd want an SU2 gauge theory instead of a U1 gauge theory?
Well.
If we wanted to do it with phi halves.
U1 level 2 mod times Z.
So if you break SO2 to G2, you get this quantized polar conductor. So if you break only to G4, do you still get quantized? Like instead of.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think almost any perturbation we could have done there that we have some symmetry would still lead to quantized polar conductor. Hall conductance, but I haven't thought in detail about other symmetry breakings. I mean, at the level of the Lagrangian we wrote down, it would be hard to do that because the anisotropic stiffness was by far the easiest perturbation to introduce. Right, the Lagrangian is free before adding the irrelevant perturbation, so I'd have to think about how to incorporate that in such a stupid model.
You need a quartic term.
I need to include the quartic term and then include the corrections.
Instead of Ex squared. Yeah. Ex squared times Ey squared.
No, I could do that. I'm just saying that would be an irrelevant perturbation to the leading behavior. So long enough wavelengths, that would flow away. I think what I wrote down is almost the only thing I can write down at the quadratic level.
I have some more questions, but I'll defer. So thank you.